Hi, I'm Siobhan Sarna, and I founded SIBO SOS. This SOS has come to mean save ourselves. And if you're new, right? So what is SIBO? It's small intestine bacterial overgrowth, the number one underlying cause of IBS. You have to find out your underlying cause for your SIBO because it's caused by something and it causes other things. Kiran Krishnan is my very special guest today. He is the co-founder of Microbiome Labs, the very famous Megaspore soil-based probiotic, maybe something you've thought about or explored or if you've never heard of it before. Cool, glad you're here. And Kiran travels the world, that's why I was just talking about Iceland, teaching researchers, doctors, microbiologists, health coaches, and everyone sort of in between about the microbiome. Recently, there's been some very exciting new developments, which is that they're coming out with even more strains. And also, in my personal opinion, even though I don't know, but this is what I'm hoping, they're reinventing and recreating how we all take care of our oral hygiene. So if you know me, you know I've created the SIBO SOS summits, the digestion SOS documentaries, the lymphatic rescue summit, the microbiome rescue summit, the dental health connection summit. Coming up in the spring, we have the liver gallbladder rescue summit. Very excited about that. And then next year in September, I'm doing the fascia rescue summit, that container of material, our fascia underneath our skin, which has so many health implications. I like to go places where not everyone is and fill in the knowledge gaps that we all have. So that's where Kiran really comes in, because he has been super generous to our community, giving us discounts that aren't available elsewhere and helping you to go direct to Microbiome Labs to be able to pick up product. And we do have a special going on. If you are listening to this live, I want to just say for the recording, if you're listening to it a year from now, this is probably not going to be true, but listen to it right now. We do have a special for you for 15% off on your entire cart with Microbiome Labs. We'll put the coupon code in the email and on Facebook and all that jazz. So you will get it. Don't worry. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to share with you Kiran Krishnan and his take on the microbiome and SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. It is somewhat different if you are a regular than what a lot of people teach. And so I'm excited to hear about it because I embrace all methods. Like, let's get her done. Okay, Kiran, take it away.
Hi, thank you so much, Siobhan. I really appreciate this opportunity. And what I'm going to take you guys on today is a little bit of a journey, an intellectual journey, let's call it, of how I explored and thought about SIBO. When you really break it down and you take a pragmatic approach to what this really is, you start to illuminate things that aren't really talked about enough when it comes to dealing with this condition. And I'll give you the ending right off the bat. Right. So this will be like some cool movie where there's a circle composition where the end of the movie starts at the end and then you figure out how you got to the end. But basically what I concluded when you start looking at all the pathologies involved, that SIBO is not a condition in and of itself. Right. That's the thing that I think we need to get away from, because when someone's experiencing SIBO, we become extremely focused on the overgrowth itself and the resulting bloat, right? That becomes the be-all, end-all of, are we helping this condition or not? And in fact, I think if you go through this journey with me, what you'll come to realize, hopefully, is that SIBO is a symptom of a bigger, longer-term problem, right? So unfortunately, what allopathic and natural medicine has done is made the symptom the target. And that's where we become, that's where we see issues. That's where we see people not really resolving this problem. When we constantly go after the overgrowth directly and we don't deal with or really understand the underlying drivers behind the overgrowth, we're not really dealing with the problem at the root cause, right? And allopathic medicine has its way of going about it, which is how they go about it. Lots of other medical conditions. In some cases, it's beneficial. In some cases, it's not. But the role of functional medicine and integrative medicine or natural medicine is that we're supposed to be going after the root cause, but we've become obsessed with the bloat. And we measure the success of any sort of treatment for SIBO by looking at whether or not it alleviated bloat in the short term, right? So that's the part that I think needs to be rethought. Now, the bloat has to go away at some point. Yes, that's not a question at all, but that is not the first thing. The bloat should eventually go away if you get to the other root causes, right? So I'm going to take you through this a little bit. And for that reason, I call this presentation going beyond the bloat. Because it's if we're really looking at the root cause of SIBO, we have to go beyond the bloat. We have to look at the other physiological issues that are driving this overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine that is leading to the bloat. The bloat, again, is a symptom of something bigger that's happening, and SIBO in general becomes a symptom of something bigger that's happening. So let me go through this for you guys. I'll shut off my camera temporarily so this thing is not in the way, and I'll bring it back on when we get into the Q&A. So first, when you start looking at conditions like SIBO, we have a label for it, right? We call it small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. There's a medical diagnosis associated with it, just like there's a medical diagnosis for IBS, and there's a percentage of IBS that's actually SIBO, or percentage of SIBO that's actually IBS. And part of it to me is all of this is in a way kind of misdirecting people and creates misdirection in terms of approach. Because these conditions are all so similar in many ways and differentiated in a few different ways, but in general, they are digestive issues that are driven by probably the same underlying factors, right? So let's just look at some of these statistics that you can find out there. So between 4 and 78% of irritable bowel syndrome is caused by SIBO. When you see a statistic like that, I pulled this off, I think CDC or something website, it's almost laughable, right? How can something be between 4 and 78%? That's like between 0 and 100. If I said, you know, between 1% and 99% of conditions are driven by this, of this condition being driven by this cause, it would be laughable, because 1 in 99 is a very different number. Just the same here, between 4 and 78% of irritable bowel syndrome is caused by SIBO. It's almost meaningless, right? It just means people's bowels aren't functioning properly the way they're supposed to. And the most common symptoms of IBS, both C and D, are abdominal pain and or discomfort, irregular stool form, passage, bloating, constipation, or diarrhea. And then, of course, the most common symptoms of SIBO are also abdominal pain or discomfort, bloating, flatulence, loose motion, constipation, and so on. Very similar overlapping symptoms, lots of similar dysfunctions, yet we have these labels for each of these things, IBS-C and IBS-D and SIBO and methane-based SIBO and hydrogen-based SIBO. And we want to label things because we want to compartmentalize them and put them in a box, because we're so used to labeling conditions and then finding a singular treatment for that one labeled condition, when all of these are actually syndromes, and all of them are likely driven by the same root cause. And how they manifest, whether the syndrome manifests as IBS-C or manifests as methane dominant SIBO, is based on where your microbiome was when it got dysfunctional. Also, it depends on what influences you around you, right? What types of foods you're exposed to, what your environment looks like and all that. That'll dictate whether this becomes chronic diarrhea or chronic constipation, or this becomes methane dominant or hydrogen dominant. All of those endpoints aren't as significant as what is driving it at the root cause. And the scary thing about this to me, when I started digging into this and going down this journey, is that when you look at the root cause dysfunctions, yes, they create these digestive issues that are really wreak havoc on your quality of life, because you can't eat things and you get this bloating response and discomfort and all of that. But the bigger underlying problems are much more serious, and they have much more long-term consequences, right? If we don't address the parts of the physiology that are falling apart and leading to these symptoms. I hope that makes sense, but you know, and this will get more clear as I go through. SIBO officially is defined as an increase in bacteria equal to or greater than 10 to the 5 colony forming units per ml of upper gut aspirate, right? So the only definitive way to know that you have SIBO is to do an invasive upper gut aspirate sample. So you put in a tube down your throat and you get samples of aspirate from your upper GI, and then they plate it and they look and see, is it higher than 10 to the 5 colony forming units, right? And 10 to the 5, keep in mind, is not a big number, right? 10 to the 5 is basically one with four zeros. With five zeros in front of it. So it's about 100,000 bacteria per ml of upper gut aspirate. And that's not a lot when it comes to bacteria. Right. So it's one with five zeros. So it's about 100,000. And when you go over 10 to the five, now you officially have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Keep in mind that the large bowel has 10 to the 12 CFUs of bacteria. That is one with 13 zeros after it. Right. That's a big number. And that's normal. That's a normal bacterial concentration of the large bowel versus the small bowel. If you are 10 to the five or more, you are now in this disease state. Right. So there's a significant difference in what the large bowel and the small bowel are supposed to house and handle when it comes to bacteria. And yet the large bowel and small bowel in many ways are quite similar in terms of the environment. The small bowel does have more oxygen, so it does favor facultative or organisms that can deal with oxygen and lack of oxygen. And the large bowel is mostly anaerobic, meaning there's no oxygen there. So that's a big difference. But for the most part, both areas are really good areas for bacteria to grow, right? The small bowel is warm, it's moist, there's lots of food coming through, lots of liquid coming through. It's there's endless substrates, there's all of this mucus layer to bind to. They can even eat away at the mucus layer. And yet, somehow bacteria are prevented from exceeding a 10 to the 5 CFU per ml of aspirate level, whereas in the large bowel, the bacteria go to crazy numbers like 10 to the 12, right? And remember, 10 to the 12 is, again, one with 13 zeros in front of it, right? That's a massive, massive number compared to the small bowel with 10, with five zeros in front of it. It's widely accepted that stasis, so the bowel's not moving, is a feature of SIBO. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, right? Because that's a fundamental function of your digestive tract, is to move, right? And there's a couple of mechanisms that drive that. And if your bowels stop moving and defecation becomes infrequent, that is a fundamental issue. That has impact on the rest of your body in many ways. And this is a fundamental feature of SIBO, right? And so to me, that's one of the things that one should hone in on as to why that is happening, right? And it's not about just, let's try to keep stimulating the bowels. Let's use prokinetics and let's, you know, try to trigger the bowels from moving. The question is, why have they stopped moving, right? And that, in talking to a lot of the clinicians that I get to work with all the time who are working on SIBO and treating patients with SIBO, that question's not asked very often. And because it's not asked, There's no approach for it. So the big question to me is, why has that stopped moving, right? And so when you think about this as a condition, and this is how I thought about it, this is where the journey starts a little bit, where you go on it with me. I had a few fundamental questions, right? And keep in mind, I haven't been working or thinking about SIBO for a very long time, because I focused my work early on leaky gut. To me, that was a key fundamental issue that needed to be addressed. And so we started doing publications on leaky gut. We developed products to be able to support and resolve this whole issue of intestinal permeability. And so that has been my focus. But about three and a half years ago, I got so much, I had so many questions from practitioners and patients all the time about SIBO and why the current approaches aren't working, both in natural and allopathic medicine. You know, the condition's just not getting better. It may get better temporarily, but it comes right back. And it's, of course, fundamentally a gut question. So that's when I started digging into it to go, let me think about this problem a little bit, right? Let's go through a mental exercise, if you will, to really break down this issue and ask the right questions about it. And that's a critical part before you can ever come or arrive to any sort of solutions. So the first question to ask is, what is overgrowing? And keep in mind, I've asked many clinicians that work with SIBO these questions, and not many of them can answer most of these questions, right? Because the focus again is, my patient gets really bloated when they eat food, so let's stop eating those foods. Step one. Number two, there's bacteria overgrowing in there, so let's kill all those bacteria. That tends to be the knee-jerk response, right? But really understanding the root causes of this has not been the focus. So the questions I ask myself are, what is overgrowing, right? Clearly something is overgrowing. And then if there is something that's overgrowing, are they dysbiotic bacteria, meaning they shouldn't be in the small bowel, or are they the native microbes in the small bowel? Because there are naturally microbes in the small bowel. Remember, they have to be below that 10 to the 5 CFUs per ml level. But nonetheless, there are bacteria there. Is it the natural bacteria in the small intestine that started to overgrow, or are these dysbiotic organisms that are coming from elsewhere? And if they are coming from elsewhere and they're not the native bacteria, where are they coming from? Right? What is feeding the system with these dysbiotic bacteria? And then if they're there, whether it's a natural microbes or dysbiotic microbes, why are they overgrowing? Right? What is driving their growth in people with SIBO compared to people who don't have SIBO? Right? How is it that microbes in the same type of environment, in my small gut versus your small gut, why is it in one person's it can grow well beyond this 10 to the 5 limit, and in other people there's this limit that's set physiologically that it doesn't exceed, right? So that is a big fundamental question. And then if stasis is an important part of SIBO, that's an underlying factor, what's driving that stasis? Why have the bowels stopped moving? That's a very important question to ask, right? And in order to understand why microbes are overgrowing in the small bowel of people with SIBO, you really have to understand, what are the natural protections against these issues, right? What protects against the stasis? What protects against the overgrowth? What protects against the inoculation by dysbiotic bacteria, if that is what's found in SIBO, right? Those are the important questions to ask, because keep in mind, even though SIBO is really prevalent, there are hundreds of millions of people out there that don't have SIBO, right? So what is it about their physiology that prevents the small bacteria from overgrowing or even arriving there if they're coming from a dysbiotic source? So these are the important things. And when you really look at SIBO, when you look at the diversity of people it affects, right? The age diversity can affect a 12-year-old just as much as it affects an 80-year-old. It can affect a man just as much as it affects a woman in almost any stage of their lives. There is no real clear pattern into who's the most higher risk individual or type of individual with this condition. And it's also quite complex in terms of the onset of the condition for different people, right? It's not always somebody that had known food poisoning. It's not always the same driver in every case of diagnosis of SIBO. And so to me, it must be multifactorial, because there are a number of ways and number of things that have to go wrong for someone to arrive at having this particular condition. And in addition, it must be driven by common behaviors. Because it's so prevalent and because it affects people in a broad spectrum, it can't be something exotic that's causing this condition, right? It can't be some unique exotic pathogen or only those who have traveled to the Amazon have this condition, right? Or only those of a certain demographic have this condition. Because it's such a prevalent condition with such a wide variety of sufferers, it has to be driven by very common behaviors, things that impact lots and lots of people. So that is the series of fundamental questions that I ask myself. And when you start digging into the literature to try to understand those questions and then the answers associated with them, the good news is there's a lot of information out there and a lot of data that points us towards the right answers, right? So the first question, what is overgrowing and are they dysbiotic or native microbes? Well, the interesting thing about SIBO is there's been a lot of study about SIBO in certain specific conditions. Like in the case of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NASH, which is non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or hepatosteatosis. In these conditions, SIBO, or the overgrowth of small bacteria over 10 to the 5 CFUs per ml of aspirate, is quite predominant, right? And because of that, in these conditions, they have done lots of studies looking at microbe samples from the small bowel, plating them, characterizing them, trying to figure out what is actually growing in these individuals when they have SIBO. As it turns out, it helps answer the question that these are dysbiotic organisms. So to begin with, the predominant microbes in a healthy small intestine, right? So these are the native microbes, if you don't have SIBO, tend to be gram-positive bacteria like Blausha or Rumnakaka ACA, right? These are examples of the normal microbes that are in that region, that are in the small intestine. Now, when you get SIBO, what you tend to find is that overgrowth in SIBO is characterized by a taxa shift. So taxa is a taxonomic, you know, how all organisms and species and all can be put in this taxonomic characterization, a taxa shift to gram-negative bacteria, right? So from gram-positive bacteria, which predominates a healthy small intestine, now in SIBO, you tend to find a shift towards a predominance of gram-negative bacteria, such as Enterobacter ACA, E. coli, Klebsiella pneumoniae, Proteus mirabilis, or Proteus mirabilis, as well as other gram-negative organisms like Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Now, many of these, if you guys are familiar with microbes, are also potential pathogens, right? They're not necessarily direct pathogens in the sense that the moment you have them colonizing, they're going to cause illness. Most of these are opportunistic organisms and potentially pathogenic. And the key is that they're gram-negative bacteria. Now, for those of you that don't know what gram-negative, gram-positive is, a quick explanation is that every bacteria in the world can be designated as gram-negative or gram-positive, right? When you take a bacteria cell and you put a stain on it called a gram stain, some bacteria absorb that strain in their cell structure because they have a cell wall around them, right? So they have a cell membrane and then a cell wall on the inside of that membrane as well. That cell wall structure will absorb the dye. And when you look at them under a microscope, they look more blue or purple. That means they're gram-positive. Gram-negative bacteria don't have that cell wall. They only have a cell membrane. And another characteristic about a gram-negative bacteria is that they have an endotoxin embedded in their cell membrane called LPS, lipopolysaccharide. That's an important thing to keep in mind as we move forward in this conversation. So just remember, taxa shift when you start seeing an overgrowth in the small bowel that's leading to a diagnosis of SIBO. You're going from gram-positive, benign bacteria like Blausha rumnakaka ACA to opportunistic pathogenic type of organisms that are gram-negative, now growing in the bowel like E. coli, Klebsiella, Enterobacter, and so on. There are some gram-positive bacteria still found, but they are more on that opportunistic spectrum. Organisms like Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, Enterococcus faecalis, Enterococcus faecium, these are gram-positive potential pathogenic organisms or opportunistic organisms that are also found in the small bowel of people with SIBO. And these, again, are not the native microbes that should be there. So as you can see, they're clearly dysbiotic bacteria. Then the big, allows us to understand what is actually overgrowing. So in SIBO, we know that it's opportunistic gram-negative and some opportunistic gram-positive bacteria that are growing, and they are dysbiotic bacteria, meaning they don't belong in the small intestine naturally. And if they don't belong in the small intestine naturally and they are dysbiotic, then the big question is, where are they coming from, right? What is the source of these organisms? And although a number of these SIBO bacteria are naturally found in the colon, to me, this is a secondary route, because when I first started talking to functional medicine doctors about SIBO 7-8 years ago, when I first just started in a cursory way looking at this thing, I always heard that these microbes in the small intestine were coming up from the large bowel past a dysfunctional ileocecal valve and entering into the small bowel that way, right? To me, that didn't quite make sense, because that's a very unusual dysfunction to occur, where your ileocecal valve is dysfunctional, and then you have this particular mix of bacteria in the proximal end of your large intestine now moving up with some force, because it has to move up to a good portion of your small intestine, and your small intestine is 20-something feet, moving up with some force up into your small intestine and inoculating the system, right? So to me, that seemed like a less plausible way for these microbes to get to where they are and remain as dysbiotic microbes. There is another source to me, which could be likely the primary source of these dysbiotic microbes, and that is the mouth, right? The mouth houses all of these dysbiotic bacteria, E. coli, Enterobacter, Proteus, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, Enterococcus. People's mouths, especially dysfunctional or unhealthy mouths, which at least 94% of Americans have unhealthy mouths, house these types of microbes at really high levels, right? And you are swallowing these microbes every single day. You're swallowing it every minute as you ingest your own saliva, right? Saliva is washing over the teeth, the gums, the soft tissue in the mouth. And then it's taking these bacteria and you're swallowing them as if you're taking a opportunistic, supplement every single day, right? You're getting large amounts of these bacteria moving into your digestive tract from your mouth every single day. And there's some connections on this, right? So it's interesting to look at these connections. When you look at 60% of diabetic patients yield oral Enterococcus faecalis and faecium, right? So think about it. Diabetic patients, at 60% of them have oral Enterococcus faecalis and faecium, compared to only 6.6% in controls, right? That means if you're diabetic, you are 10 times more likely to have Enterococcus faecalis and Enterococcus faecium in your mouth, right? At the same time, diabetics also have a much higher prevalence rate of having SIBO, right? A recent study found that SIBO is present in 43% of diabetic patients with chronic diarrhea, and 75% of them had improvements in their symptoms after being treated with antibiotics. What does that say? That says that diabetic individuals have exposure to opportunistic or pathogenic organisms that are causing SIBO-like symptoms. And when you use an antibiotic and kill bacteria, that seems to alleviate the symptoms, right? So that means there's a source of microbes entering into their system, that if that source is slowed down by an antibiotic, the symptoms abate. And so that is a really interesting connection. And keep in mind, one of the two of the species that are SIBO dysbiotic bacteria are Enterococcus faecalis and Enterococcus faecium. So this shows diabetics who have a higher tendency to have SIBO also have a high tendency to have Enterococcus faecalis and faecium. They tend to have SIBO-like symptoms when those microbes are found, and those microbes are found readily in their mouth, as well as in their small intestine as overgrowth microbes, right? So this is just a rough connection just to show you that there's some line of thinking here, that there's a connection between the oral microbiome and a chronic condition like diabetes, and how that chronic condition like diabetes is also related to something like SIBO, and how the same dysbiotic bacteria in the mouth of people with diabetes is also present in the small bowel of people with SIBO, and diabetics and SIBO tend to share a lot of commonalities as well, right? So again, this is just to demonstrate that there are connections here. This is not definitive. It's not diagnostic in that way, but it just shows you that there's an influence on what is growing in your mouth to what happens to your system chronically. And that can impact things like metabolic health and diabetes, or it can impact digestive health, as in the case of SIBO. Now, the next big question is, and because we know now that there are dysbiotic bacteria in the small bowel and they are overgrowing past that 10 to the 5 limit, then the big question is, why are they overgrowing, right? And why don't these types of microbes grow in other people that don't have SIBO? That leads us to understanding the natural protective mechanisms against small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Because remember, I mentioned earlier that the small intestine is a great place for bacteria to grow, right? There's lots of moisture. There's food coming in constantly. It's warm. There's all of these binding sites in the mucosa. So bacteria really should be growing there quite readily all the time at very high levels, similar to the large intestine where you find 10 to the 12 CFUs of bacteria, right? So what is it about the small intestine that naturally maintains a low level of bacteria? The first thing is stomach acid. So stomach acid acting as a gastric barrier, that means the number of bacteria that are entering into your small intestine through the oral cavity in a viable state should be low, because your stomach acid should kill most of the bacteria you are swallowing, whether it's coming through food, water, drink sources, or your own saliva, right? So most of the microbes entering into the digestive tract, into the stomach, and eventually into the small intestine should be inactivated by stomach acid. So then they don't pose a threat as serving as an inoculation source for the small intestine, right? So stomach acid is one of the key protectors. The second one is bile secretion and the bile acid pool. As you guys know, bile is formed by the liver, stored in the gallbladder, and then secreted into the small intestine when food is present. And bile plays a number of roles. One of the key roles that bile plays is it acts as an antimicrobial. And I'll talk a little bit more about bile in a second, but keep in mind that bile is a super important component of maintaining a low level of microbes in the small intestine. Bile is not present in the large intestine. And that's one of the big differentiating factors as to why the large intestine can have such a high amount of bacteria, whereas the small intestine has this ceiling of a certain number of bacteria and doesn't allow it to exceed that. The other one is the activation of the FXR nuclear receptor by bile. I'll talk about that again a little bit more as we go along. But again, bile plays this dual important role in maintaining low levels of bacteria. Then, of course, the fourth one is peristalsis. That's the movement of the bowels. The bowels are constantly moving, especially in the small intestine, and moving things like food along so that food cannot sit in any given spot in the small intestine for a very long time. Now, when you look at bacteria growth, right? So when you take bacteria and you try to grow them on a plate and you give them all the food they want on that plate, bacteria go through two phases of growth. There's a lag phase of growth and then a log phase of growth, right? The lag phase is where the bacteria is just starting to metabolize the food and start turning on the correct genes to start multiplying. And it takes the bacteria some period of time before it starts to do the logarithmic growth, right? Normally, it takes 12 to 24 hours for most bacteria to get out of that slow lag phase and start going into the sharp log phase growth. It's no different than leaving some food out on the counter. It doesn't spoil immediately. It doesn't spoil in 3 hours, right? It doesn't spoil in 10 hours. More often than not, you have to leave it overnight, 12 hours, 16 hours, 24 hours before it actually goes spoiled. And the reason for that is all of these microbes have this lag phase and log phase growth. Now, when you think about the digestive tract, when food enters the small intestine, right, that then becomes a source of fuel for the microbes that are in the small intestine to start metabolizing the food and start growing. But all of the microbes in the small intestine have that lag phase in their growth cycle, right? Which means that in order for food to provide them enough energy so that they can enter log phase growth, the food has to sit in the small intestine for more than 12 hours. But it doesn't, because the peristaltic activity is so important in moving food along at a given pace so that your bowels can be emptied typically within a 12 to 14 hour period, right? So this natural movement of food through peristalsis does not allow food to sit in the small intestine long enough for bacteria to utilize it to start going into this log phase growth and then reaching super high numbers. Now, it's different once it hits this large intestine. It can sit in the large intestine longer. And keep in mind, the large intestine is not as long and doesn't have as much length as the small intestine. So any given area where the food remains in the large intestine, it remains for longer than it normally does in the small intestine. That gives the microbes in the large intestine ample time to consume that food, metabolize it, and go into their log phase growth. And that's part of the reason why the microbial concentration in the large intestine is so high. And then, of course, a migrating mortar complex is this wonderful electrical sweeping that occurs that cleans out the bowels, right? It cleans out the stomach, the small intestine, and it even helps shape the large intestine. And again, it's another clearing and movement of things out of the small intestine to keep it from becoming a place where putrefaction or fermentation can occur. So these are the mechanisms that are in place in individuals that do not have SIBO. When you compare two people, let's say they're basically almost the same health, you know, same age, same weight and everything, and one has SIBO and one doesn't. The person that does not have SIBO, the reason why they don't have overgrowth of their small intestines, overgrowth of the bacteria in their small intestines, because they have these five mechanisms working. These five mechanisms prevent the overgrowing of bacteria in the small bowel. The person with SIBO has at least one, if not multiple, many of these conditions not functioning properly, right? That's the crux of it all. We don't, if you have SIBO, it's because your natural protection against bacteria being allowed to overgrow and dysbiotic bacteria to inoculate that space, those mechanisms aren't functioning. Now let's look at this, the natural protective mechanisms against SIBO, and we'll take each one of them one by one, right? So the first one is stomach acid, acting as a gastric barrier. There are so many things in society today that compromise our stomach acid production, right? Stress is one of the biggest ones, right? Zinc deficiency is another one. H. pylori infection, we know that at least 50% of the population is infected with H. pylori. And then, of course, the use of PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, and antacids. So we have ample reason for stomach acid production to become compromised. And remember, if stomach acid production is compromised, then the gastric barrier is not functioning. That means you're swallowing opportunistic gram-negative pathogens every minute of every day, and more of those opportunistic gram-negative pathogens from your mouth are entering into your small bowel in a viable state, meaning they're not killed off and protected it from in your stomach, right? They're entering into the small bowel in a viable state where they're going to start to fight for colonization, right? So H. pylori, stress, zinc deficiency, these are the things that are driving it, and PPI and antacid use is probably one of the most prevalent. If you just look at those two, just look at H. pylori, antacid, and let's throw in stress, right? What percentage of the population has chronic stress? In the adult population, it's almost 30%, right? There's chronic stress. H. pylori infection, at least 50% of the adult population has H. pylori infection. And when you look at PPIs and antacid use, PPIs were in the top three classes of drugs prescribed until they became over-the-counter, and now they're one of the top over-the-counter drugs being used by the population today. Those three things are supremely common and are found as very, very common behaviors. Remember, one of my rules when I was going through this is, one of the things that are driving SIBO are going to be very common behaviors because there's so many people that are dealing with this and the prevalence is so high, right? Stress, H. pylori overgrowth, PPI use are extremely, extremely common. And when you look at the studies, right? So when you look at, this is a diagram of stomach acid production, not important. You guys either know this or don't, and it doesn't matter whether you know it or don't. But what's really important is that there's a significant number of studies showing that proton pump inhibitor use, which remember, proton pump inhibitors are medication used to help with acid reflux. The hypothesis is acid reflux is due to an overproduction of stomach acid, which we all know now, and the research is clear that that's not the case. It's not an overproduction of stomach acid, right? There are other factors driving the pressure in the stomach that is causing a regurgitation of that stomach acid. But anyway, PPIs are designed to slow down and or stop stomach acid production. And here's a meta-analysis paper, which is a systematic review of a whole bunch of studies. They concluded that several meta-analyses and systematic reviews have reported that patients treated with PPIs, as well as patients who are post-gastrectomy, that means they remove the stomach, have a higher frequency of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth compared to patients who lack the aforementioned conditions. At this time, PPI-induced dysbiosis is considered a type of SIBO, right? So if the mouth is the primary source of dysfunctional bacteria and SIBO, it makes absolute sense that if you compromise the gastric barrier, the thing that's supposed to protect us from viable opportunistic organisms coming from the mouth to the small intestine, if that barrier is compromised, then it should lead, that compromisation should lead to a high incidence rate of SIBO. And sure enough, it does. And the studies show that it does, right? So one underlying factor in the presence of SIBO is, where is your stomach acid production, right? What has compromised it? Are you dealing with stress, right? Is stress management a part of your SIBO protocol? Likely not, right? If you think about it, is H. pylori treatment or addressing part of your SIBO protocol? Likely not. Is zinc deficiency part of it, right? Are you compensating, or you're being compensated for the long-term use of PPIs and antacids? Right? These are critical things if we want to deal with the root cause of SIBO. So that's just one example. Let's go, and here's another increased incidence of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth during proton pump inhibitor use. And they showed that SIBO was detected in 50% of patients using PPIs, 24.5% of those patients with IBS, and 6% of healthy controls, right? So 5 times more likely to have SIBO if you're using proton pump inhibitors compared to controls. These were statistically significant difference between patients using PPIs and those with IBS or healthy control subjects. I mean, the data is absolutely clear. The next natural protective mechanism. So that was stomach acid and the gastric barrier. This one is the bile secretions. And then the other, second part of the bile secretion, is the FXR nuclear receptor, right? So remember, bile is made in the liver, stored in the gallbladder. And then when you start eating food, your body secretes bile from the gallbladder into the duodenum, into the small intestine. And bile plays a role in a number of ways. Number one, it helps you absorb fat-soluble nutrients. It also binds up fat and lipid soluble toxins and takes it back to the liver for detoxing and removal from the body. And then it also maintains low levels of bacterial growth, because most of the native bacteria that live in the small intestine are sensitive to bile. Bile is a pretty strong antimicrobial. And if you combine bile with some long chain fatty acids in the diet, it actually has a surfactant soap-like quality to maintain low levels of bacterial growth. Because remember, the highest risk for bacterial growth comes when you're eating food, right? Because you're providing a substrate to the bacteria, assuming your bowel's not moving that well, or it should be moving like we talked about earlier, the peristalsis, but the food provides a substrate for the bacteria to sit and start metabolizing and start to overgrow. Bile is secreted up to 15 times, recycled during a single meal. As it moves through the small intestine, it coats the small intestine, which means that it's coating all the bacteria in the small intestine, which means it's providing a natural antimicrobial or bacteriostatic effect to the bacteria in the small intestine. So even though food is present, bile is not allowing those microbes to metabolize the food and start to overgrow, right? It's acting as a bacteriostatic. Now, at the same time, bile keeps secreting through. It goes into the duodenum, moves all throughout the small intestine, and then gets reabsorbed in the ileum, which is the very end of the small intestine. And when it gets reabsorbed in the ileum, it goes back to the liver. It takes fat-soluble vitamins and nutrients and deposits it in the liver. It takes the toxins that it picked up and starts having the liver detox it. Then bile gets cleaned up and refurbished and recycled back to the gallbladder for secretion again. Remember, in one meal, you can have the same bile acid pool released and recycled through the small intestine 15 times. Right? And then on its way to the terminal end of the small intestine, bile also activates something called the FXR nuclear receptor. By activating the FXR nuclear receptor, it turns on the intestinal epithelial cells in the small intestine to secrete antimicrobial compounds. right? So think about that. Not only is it acting as a bacteria static, preventing bacteria from growing in the presence of food, it's also causing the intestinal lining to release antimicrobial compounds to start bringing down and managing bacterial levels during a meal. So bile plays a two-phase role here, right? So, and clearly it's a natural protective mechanism against allowing bacteria to overgrow in the small bowel. So it would be logical then if bile is somehow compromised, meaning your liver is compromised and you're not producing as much bile as you should be, your bile acid pool is diminishing with each cycle, and your bile acid pool is not being cleaned up properly because you don't have a healthy liver, it would stand to reason then that liver dysfunctions will be associated with SIBO, right? Because bile, the natural protective mechanism, is not functioning. So this goes through bile itself. But when you look at the studies, it becomes pretty clear that liver disease symptoms in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth are absolutely related. What they showed here is some studies reinforce the concept that small intestinal bacterial overgrowth plays an important role in the pathogenesis of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease through endotoxins, which come from bacteria, and the activation of tumor necrosis factor as mediators. So what this is showing is that there's a correlation and a relationship between having small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and the progression and the development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So with liver dysfunction goes small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And this is mediated through an inflammatory pathology and the presence of endotoxins, which I'll talk about in a second. Right, so this connection is there. And then there are more studies looking at the prevalence of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth in association with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which of course, if you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, it means your bile acid pool and the ability of your liver to produce bile and circulate bile and work, use the bile circulatory pathway effectively is compromised, right? So in this study, they looked at 372 eligible people, meaning people that could have SIBO because they presented that way. 141, which is almost 38% of them, tested positive for SIBO, which that's called a study group. So there's people that tested positive for SIBO are the study group, and 231, 62% were negative for it. So that's a control group, right? So we had people with similar symptoms, some control group, no SIBO, study group, yes SIBO. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease occurred in 45.4% of the study group, right? So if those diagnosed with SIBO, 45% of them also demonstrated non-alcoholic fatty liver disease compared to 17% in the control group, right? So quite significant, almost 2.5 times more likely to have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease if you're diagnosed with SIBO. Patients in the study group were found to have higher rates of elevated aspartate aminotransferase and alanine aminotransferase. These are liver enzymes that are detected at elevated levels when your liver is dysfunctional. And they also had higher levels of type 2 diabetes. We made the diabetes connection earlier as well, and as well as hypertension and metabolic syndrome, right? So all of these larger scale chronic illnesses all go along with this same pathology. So it's not just about the bloat, because the bloat is in part caused by the liver not functioning the way it should. And when the liver doesn't function the way it should, there are much bigger problems to be had than bloating, right? We're now going into a space of other kinds of chronic illnesses like diabetes, like hypertension, like cardiovascular disease, right? And immune dysfunctions that are associated with it. Immune compromisation is a big issue in these kind of pathologies, right? Just think about in this pandemic, who had 10 times higher mortality rate than healthy individuals were people with diabetes. People with diabetes had 10 times mortality rate with the current pandemic than people who did not have diabetes who were of the same age. Same thing with hypertension. They had 6 to 7 times higher mortality rate than people who did not have hypertension who are the same age, right? So these conditions are all significant drivers of overall chronic dysfunction that goes well beyond the bloat that one may be experiencing at the moment, right? Because the liver is involved in all of this dysfunction, including SIBO. So that's, this is part of the drivers to think about this in a different way. The other protective mechanism is peristalsis and the migrating motor complex. We talked about how important it is for peristalsis to function because it has to keep the food moving through the system, because if food stays for too long in the small bowel, it gives an opportunity for putrefaction, right? And it gives an opportunity for microbes in the small intestine to start utilizing the food in a maximum way and reach their logarithmic growth, thereby reaching very high concentrations in the small bowel and also creating toxic compounds and byproducts from that. Compounds like p-cresol, right? Ammonia, all of these things, and hydrogen sulfide, right? These are all things that are toxic to the system, drive major inflammation, drive significant leaky gut. This all tends to happen in people who are getting fermentation effect in the small bowel. And it's, and part of that is because the food is not moving through fast enough because of the stasis and the lack of peristalsis, right? And the migrating motor complex also gets compromised in the same fashion. And if it is compromised, then we're not cleaning and sweeping the bowels, right? And all of these types of conditions like celiac, gastroparesis, enteropathy, diabetes, hypochlorohydria, which is a lack of course of HCl, all of these things drive this condition of stasis. And then of course, LPS, lipopolysaccharide that I mentioned earlier, that was in connection between SIBO and liver disease, that LPS was one of the linchpins of driving the connection between SIBO and liver disease. LPS, lipopolysaccharide, from where? From gram-negative bacteria, is also a critical part of what drives the peristalsis and migrating motor complex dysfunction. Remember, first slide showed that, or second slide showed that the types of bacteria that are overgrowing in SIBO are gram-negative bacteria, whereas the healthy bacteria in the small intestine should be gram-positive bacteria. One of the features of having gram-negative bacteria means you have a lot of LPS, lipopolysaccharide, because gram-negative bacteria have this LPS in their cell membrane, whereas gram-positive bacteria don't. So if you have SIBO, you have SIBO dysbiosis in your small intestine, now you're producing lots of LPS, lipopolysaccharide. Right? And LPS is a key thing that stops the bowel from moving, if you look at these studies. So here's one interesting study published in 2014. And this was looking at pediatric small intestinal bacterial overgrowth in low-income countries. We've all seen pictures in third world countries that are inundated with poverty and famine and all that. You see the kids with that really bloated bellies, right? So SIBO is a feature here. And they were studying this as how does this occur in these low income countries? And they found that their hypothesis that the mechanism of SIBO development in the setting of unsanitary living conditions stems from repeated exposure to abnormal levels of lipopolysaccharide. These are gram negative pathogens that are getting footholds and exposure to individuals that end up developing SIBO. And this is, in this case, in the low-income countries, it's via contaminated soil and drinking water, which abrogates the migrating motor complex, leading to luminal stasis. So what they were able to show is that when you get high levels of gram-negative bacteria through exposure, and those gram-negative bacteria produce their LPS, that LPS drives an abrogation of the migrating motor complex and peristalsis, which leads to the stasis of the bowel, right? And even though we're not in a low-income country, at least most people on this presentation aren't, we know that we're constantly swallowing gram-negative bacteria, right? So gram-negative bacteria coming from the mouth are being swallowed. Your stomach acid is compromised, so they're getting into the small bowel in a viable state. You're not producing enough bile acids to maintain lower levels of them during feeding. And so when you're feeding them. And when you're feeding them, they are generating LPS. And when they generate LPS, they drive leaky gut, which ends up affecting peristalsis in the migrating motor complex. I'll show you how that happens. In animal models, E. coli is a gram-negative pathogen or opportunistic organisms. The LPS derived from E. coli has been shown to decrease both the frequency and strength of small intestinal contractions and to eliminate the migrating motor complex, right? Just think about that. Contractions are dramatically reduced, both the frequency and the strength of it, and the migrating motor complex, the MMC, that's so important, is eliminated. That's the presence of E. coli-derived LPS in the small intestine, right? And we're swallowing E. coli all the time. It's one of the most common fecal-oral contaminants that we find in society today. Now, how does this happen? Here's a study that looked at how exactly LPS causes this stopping of the bowel. What they were able to show is that when LPS is allowed to leak through a leaky gut, a leaky small intestine, the LPS gets into the enteric nervous system. It moves up the enteric nervous system to an area right by the brainstem called a dorsal vagal complex. The dorsal vagal complex is a centralized region where signals from the brain channel through that to get to the bowel to tell the bowel to move and to turn on, whether it's a migrating motor complex or the peristaltic movement. When the LPS gets into this dorsal vagal complex, it triggers an inflammatory response that is mediated through an inflammatory cytokine called TNF-alpha. When TNF-alpha is activated, it creates enough inflammation, enough damage to the dorsal vagal complex that the signals from the brain to the gut that are supposed to go to the gut to move aren't making its way to the gut, right? So the LPS and the resulting inflammation that it's caused in the dorsal vagal complex has stopped and roadblocked the signals from the brain that tell the gut to move. And what was interesting about this is it was not possible to elicit gastric motility via prokinetics, right? So think about how often we see people where the bowels are stopped and we know that because they have SIBO and then they're given prokinetics and the prokinetics don't really help. And that's because if you have LPS driven stasis in the bowel, which I think most people with SIBO do through leaky gut, then even the prokinetics can't jumpstart the system because the signals from the brain, which is the source of the signal, are not making it to the enteric nervous system. And what they found, this is a follow-up study to the previous, what they found is when they bound up or inhibited the expression of TNF-alpha from LPS being in their dorsal vagal complex, they were able to regenerate that kinetic signal to start peristalsis in the migrating motor complex. Right, so it's the inflammatory response in the dorsal vagal complex because of the presence of LPS, which leaked in because of intestinal permeability. It's that is that inflammatory response in that dorsal vagal complex that stops the signals from making its way to the gut. So it would stand to reason that if we can stop LPS from leaking through and entering into the enteric nervous system and making its way to the dorsal vagal complex, if we can stop that, we should dramatically help get the bowels starting to move again, right? And leaky gut with LPS endotoxemia is an extremely common problem. We saw this in the very first publication that we did, where we screened a little over 100 college students. And these are healthy, normal students. So they didn't have any conditions that they reported. They were never diagnosed for anything. And yet, 50 to 55% of them had severe endotoxemia that's represented by this type of response to food, right? Meaning every time they ate food, this is at time zero, they came in fasted, and then we give them a meal here. And within the next 5 hours, you see this massive six-fold increase in the amount of LPS in their circulation. Mm-hmm. That means all of that LPS had been generated in the gut and migrated past the intestinal lining is now floating around in circulation, making its way to the brain, up the brain stem, and so on, right? 55% of healthy normals had this. So LPS endotoxemia is super common, just as stress is super common and zinc deficiency and H. pylori infection and the use of antacids and PPI. And unfortunately, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and fatty liver disease are all also becoming more and more common. So all of these drivers that we know are dismantling the natural protective effects that we are natural protective mechanisms that we have against allowing small intestinal bacteria to overgrow. All of these are extremely, extremely common, right? So, and one here's another underlying problem that we see is because people with SIBO cannot handle carbohydrates, right? Carbohydrates become extremely uncomfortable for them to consume because you get a lot of bloating and discomfort and distension in the belly. A lot of times, SIBO people start shifting their dietary bulk from carbohydrates towards fat or protein. And the problem with this is that with endotoxemia, the amount of LPS making its way into the system, leaking through, is increased based on the amount of fat that you consume in your diet, right? And if that's if your gut is not healthy. So if your gut is healthy, you can be resistant to this, which we were able to show in this first publication. But if your gut is not healthy, it's dysfunctional, which most SIBO IBS patients have a dysfunctional gut, then the increase in fat intake in your diet is actually going to increase LPS, which means that more LPS is getting into the enteric nervous system, clouding up the signals from the brain, and doesn't, which means that it does not allow that individual's peristaltic activity and migrating motor complex to recover, right? So it's not a way of dealing with the root cause, the avoidance of foods that create bloat, because that avoidance pushes you towards foods that will actually make the underlying problem worse. So what would be a comprehensive approach to managing this whole, all the underlying structure function issues, right, within SIBO? To me, in addition to targeting the overgrowth, either with antibiotics or antimicrobials, and that's really a choice. In my view, I don't think you need to target the overgrowth first with antibiotics or antimicrobials, but you know, some people still want to and their doctors are happy to do it. So if you are doing that, in addition to that, it becomes important to address the underlying issues of stasis, of the bowel not moving, which is mediated by LPS and leakiness in the gut. Also the systemic TNF-alpha upregulation and the central motility aberration that follows, right? So that becomes important. Prokinetics, remember, will not help much if the dorsal vagal complex is compromised by LPS and by leaky gut. So to stop the reoccurrence of SIBO and let the bowels actually start moving, which is a critical part of protecting against SIBO, LPS endotoxemia has to be addressed. And how often is LPS endotoxemia being addressed in your treatment protocols for SIBO? Low HCl and gastroparesis, the slowing down of gastric emptying, must also be addressed, right? And I hardly ever see these things being addressed when patients are being managed for SIBO. Liver support is absolutely critical. We talked about how critical the liver is in terms of its bile production and cleansing of bile and recycling of bile and bile's ability to activate the FXR nuclear receptor, all of the roles that bile plays in maintaining a low level of bacterial growth in the small intestine. All of those jobs are extremely important there, and they count on having a healthy liver. And then to reduce the risk of comorbidities that come along with SIBO-like symptoms, mucosal damage and mucosal inflammation, that's the inflammation to the mucosa in the small intestine, which inevitably gets damaged because of all the inflammation that goes on in the small bowel in people with SIBO and IBS. In order to reduce the risk of the development of comorbidities from those damage, from that damage, the mucosal inflammation and rebuilding has to be addressed. Colonic sacrolytic bacteria, these are the microbes that can convert things like proteins and carbohydrates into really, really beneficial gut healing short chain fatty acids. These bacteria in most people with SIBO have not had adequate food source because people with SIBO tend to cut out most of their carbohydrates and vegetables and fibers and all that, which is what these colonic sacrolytic bacteria need. So being able to re-stimulate the colonic sacrolytic bacteria with the right types of prebiotics and so on is also going to be important. And we mentioned the whole gastroparesis issue and liver support. So one of the products that we had put together to support people with this dysfunction in the gut is the product called MegaGuard. And MegaGuard is so important because it has three major components in it that all address some of the key underlying dysfunctions in overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine. So number one is ginger root. And ginger root accelerates gastric emptying and soothes out nausea and other discomfort in the gut, right? So one of the issues within SIBO is a slowing down of gastric emptying. So this ginger helps move things along faster. Gut Guard, which is a licorice flavonoid, which protects the gastric mucosa and balances H. pylori levels. That's going to become extremely important as well, because remember, elevated H. pylori levels and its resulting compromise of stomach acid production is likely a prevalent issue within this condition. And so having and supporting a healthy level of H. pylori, and it's normal for H. pylori to be in your stomach to a certain level, but once it moves up and grows past a certain level, it becomes very problematic. And so maintaining and supporting a healthy level of H. pylori is a really important part. And that's what Gut Guard does. And finally, the artichoke leaf extract, which is actually a prescription product in parts of Europe like Germany, will stimulate bile production and balances cholesterol levels, right? So with just this one product alone, you're helping address gastric emptying, which slows down dramatically in people with overgrowth. It helps address the issue of imbalance H. pylori and damaged mucosal lining. And then it also helps address the issue of bile and bile secretion, as well as balancing bile against other fatty acids, right? So this is one very important product that can help with supporting your SIBO patients. And then other recommendations, right? Number one, using FODMAPE. So a lot of people who are suffering from SIBO and IBS and so on, they're very sensitive to FODMAPs in diet, right? FODMAPs are the fermentable carbohydrates. So they go on a low FODMAP diet, which means you're basically eliminating lots and lots and lots of healthy foods that a lot of your large bowel bacteria need. Now, it's great to be able to consume those foods without all of that bloating and distension, all the the discomfort feeling. And so FODMAPE is an enzyme product designed to actually break down FODMAPs in the stomach and then in the small intestine so that they don't cause a problem for the individual with bloating, distension, and so on. It's been one of our greatest successes in terms of launches. And we've been sold out of it almost four times since August or since July, since when we launched it. So FODMAPE becomes a really important companion to when you eat, because that will allow you to eat a broader spectrum of things, especially things like fibers and plant-based material that provide a lot of roughage and fibers. It allows you to eat that without compromising and having suffering from the consequences of consuming them. You pair that with MegaGuard right off the bat with every meal, right? Because remember, MegaGuard will help the gastric emptying, will help H. pylori balance, will help bile flow. That's all critically important when you eat food. Adding the FODMAPE to it will give you a wider sense of what you can actually consume, including foods that are good for your large bowel, because those microbes are heavily restricted and compromised when you don't eat lots of fiber and plant roughage and so on. If you are doing an antimicrobial, or even if you're not, but especially if you're doing an antimicrobial, we always recommend that you start with IgG, Mega IgG 2000 and HU58. Mega IgG 2000 is an immunoglobulin product, and those immunoglobulins, which are IgG form of the immunoglobulins, do bind up to things like toxins and so on that are released during a change in your microbiome, right? And then HU58 is one of the key spores that we work with in Megaspore. What it's been demonstrated to do is be very powerful at competing against problematic organisms, right? So if you've got problematic organisms that are being shaken up in your bowel because of an antimicrobial, antibiotic, or whatever you might be on, you might want this HU58 to be considered, because you want to ensure that the use of an antibacterial, antimicrobial of some sort doesn't favor the regrowth of opportunistic bacteria more, which often it does, right? And so having this kind of protective strain in there will help mitigate the overgrowth of these problematic organisms. And then towards the end, let's say you did decide to do the antimicrobial and you did it for 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Certainly towards the end of it, you need to start looking at Megaspore to start sealing up the gut lining so that LPS doesn't leak through. You need to look at the modulatory effects that the Megaspore has, Megaspore blend has on immune response, where it can actually reduce the severity of inflammatory types of responses in the body. We see it helping and supporting the immune system to deal with problematic organisms. We see a positive change in the microbiome in terms of diversity and the presence of keystone species when you start utilizing the Megaspore biotic. And then the Megamucosa is really important to rebuilding the mucosal lining that inevitably gets damaged during the course of having and dealing with SIBO. Right, so those two become extremely important as well. And then Mega Pre, even though lots of people at SIBO get very paranoid when you start talking about prebiotics, if you are dealing with the other dysfunctional systems, the oral cavity, the presence of pathogens in the mouth, the lack of HCl production, the poor bile flow and bile recycling, the loss of peristaltic movement and all that, if you're starting to address all of those things, you can certainly start using small amounts of a prebiotic. In our case, about a quarter of a scoop, or maybe even less, mixed in a large glass of water and sipped throughout the day. That'll provide some critical oligosaccharides for your large bowel bacteria that haven't had adequate food sources because you haven't been able to consume lots of carbohydrates and fiber. Right, so this is a really important start. Now, there's another one I would add on here, which I don't think I have a picture of, but ZenBiome. Right. Remember, we talked about how stress is a big driver of dysfunction when it comes to HCl production in the stomach. Being able to manage stress, in our case, using a psychobiotic we call ZenBiome, which significantly reduces stress, reduces cortisol levels, improves sleep indices, all kinds of positive impacts on the brain. Adding that in can really help those that are dealing with chronic stress, which is likely a source of causing problems with their HCl production, right? So this is really the look that I came up with when you consider SIBO and you really dig through the pathology. And what I found is that in clinical practice, rarely are the other issues surrounding SIBO addressed effectively, right? Liver function, HCl production, gut lining, intestinal permeability, so the LPS issue, rarely are these things all a normal part of people's SIBO protocols. And if you're not addressing these underlying root cause drivers, then the likelihood of overcoming this condition becomes much, much less, right? So that is my journey into SIBO. Of course, when I was doing it, I read, probably, 200-300 papers. So much more than I showed you here today. This is an abbreviated version, so it's easy to understand, but the science is there. Science is pointing towards what the underlying root causes are of people that exemplify overgrowth in the small intestine. And then the most important part to me is those underlying root causes are also the root causes for lots of chronic illnesses. Right. So just focusing on the bloat and going after that and then not seeing a reduction in bloat in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, creating discouragement from people that whatever they're doing is not working, that we have to get away from, because unless we get away from that mentality, we really can't address the root cause effectively. So
I want to ask you a couple of specifics. Karen, come on back on camera, handsome.
Let's see.
Okay, do not think that he's saying you need to take all those supplements all in one sitting or all at the same time or any of that. He's just showing you the lineup. So that is not what he's saying. But notice while Karen was talking, I put on lipstick and earrings and a necklace. Yay! It's the holiday edition.
I love it.
Thank you, Karen. That was very comprehensive. A couple of really powerful questions based on your content includes what are we doing for the oral microbiome? So just as a background, I've been working on these projects for years now. And thank you, Karen, for diving in with me on the SIBO bandwagon. And Karen and I have talked about the oral microbiome on multiple occasions. And it is, I'll never forget, I was with him in Seattle at the W Hotel at a convention. And he started talking to me about the mouth, and we talked about the toothpaste we like and stuff. And mm-hmm. I was just like, you know, when you get the tingle, I was like, this has got to be related. Oh my gosh. I just really feel it's related. And so fast forward 3 years later, I have done the Dental Health Connection Summit based on that original spark, kind of, because I also met Hal Huggins, the sort of father of biological dentistry in the United States back in the 80s. But anyway, what are you brewing for our oral microbiome, sir?
Yeah, so a couple of things. We have a product coming out, hopefully by late spring of next year, which is a combination of an enzyme and flavonoid that you use as a lozenge. And what we've been able to show over a few years of studies that it helps break down the plaque formation on the in the mouth. And why plaque formation becomes an issue is because as plaque becomes layered and becomes deeper, right, you get different microbes that can grow in different layers. It becomes more and more anaerobic over time as the layers become thicker and thicker. So you actually start developing colonization, a higher density of these types of microbes in your mouth, and you start favoring certain types of opportunistic anaerobic pathogens. And that ends up being a high predominance in your mouth when you have plaque building up to that level. You also start to get lots of caries and all that, of course, because of the acid production and all that we know of. But that in itself, just breaking down and maintaining a low layer of plaque. You don't want to eliminate plaque. It is protective at a certain level, but maintaining that low level of plaque is really important in reducing the overall concentration of bacteria and the dysbiosis in the mouth itself. So that's one thing. And then we've also, you know, have a version of the, which you may not be able to see. This is the Biocidin spray, right? But we have one called Megacidin, which is the same product with the spores in it, right? So we work with biobotanical research on this product. And this we use as an oral spray. And as we know, the biobotanical ingredient in there provides some degree of antimicrobial function to keep the levels of bacteria low. But then the probiotics also get into the gingival tissue and in the buccal immune tissue and help stimulate immune response in the mouth soft tissue to help your immune system control the growth of pathogens in there as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you very much for your generous coupon. You have extended it. Just everyone knows he's extended the coupon till the end of the month of this month. So again, if you're watching the recording, that's why you need to open those emails so you can get in on it early. But he has extended that 15% off. The link is in the chat, and you need to type in SIBO SOS is the patient code, and then NOBLOAT 15 is the coupon code. I need to let you go. Thank you so much, Karen, for everything. Happy holidays to you. We're looking forward to 2022 with you and the new product for the mouth. And I'll answer some just random questions here that are not Karen related, but I know we've kept you over time. So I really appreciate it. Love you so much.
Mwah. Happy Thank holidays. You. Happy New Year to everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Love you. Bye-bye. Thank you. Thank you. I want to ask you if you would type into the chat some love for Karen. We do cut and paste it and send it to him and our speakers. I did want to address a couple of things because we did get some consistent questions about prokinetics. So, you know, I run a Facebook group with 22,000 people in it and I love it. And we're in there practically 24/7. And there's so many smart people in there that have become self-educated and educated through the summits and through the SIBO Recovery Roadmap course and all of that. Prokinetics can be incredibly effective. So whether it's ginger, whether it's prucalopride, whether it is, I can see it, Modal Pro, there are a lot of prokinetics that really do work beautifully. It's not a laxative, so you need to be aware of that. It is something that does stimulate the migrating motor complex. So I know he said that he wasn't like, he's seen them not work. That's true, they don't work for everybody, but they do work for a lot of people. So I don't want anyone to be discouraged about that. Richard is asking, doesn't the antimicrobials and the Megacidin a kill off the probiotics in the formulation? That's a great question. Curon's not really in the business of killing off the good part of the formulation. I see where you're going with that, but I would imagine they've already figured that part out. LDN is a weak prokinetic and is amazing for people's immune systems. But what I've seen based on all of the people I've talked to, which is hundreds now about these topics, LDN combined with another prokinetic is really a great combo. And LDN is low dose naltrexone. If you want more information on it, you can go to LDNresearchTrust.org. And it changed my life. I had psoriasis and it cleared my scalp, which is, if you know anyone with psoriasis in their scalp, they call it heartbreak with psoriasis for a reason. Try being on TV with that. It sucked. So it's a miracle. You have to do it properly. It could give you vivid dreams, but that's actually a sign that it's working. I take mine in the morning. You can find out more about it in the SIBO SOS Facebook group. And Kathleen, you know, the IBSD, I want to make sure I understand exactly what your initials mean. Carol, oh, wow. Carol, you stayed out of the sunshine for your walk to listen to this? I wish you could just have listened to it on your phone or something. I'm glad you're with us, though. Get out there and get some vitamin D, girl, with a big hat and sunscreen. So thank you for posting on there. You know, that artichoke, you've got to try it. You've got to experiment with it. If it appeals to you, it's a miracle for some people. That's the thing about SIBO. So the underlying causes that he was talking about are that bacteria overgrowth, obviously. But remember that from food poisoning, from Dr. Pimentel, he has shown that when you've had food poisoning, not everybody, but many people, it creates confusion in the intestines through molecular mimicry. It slows down the migrating motor complex, which leads to the bacteria hanging out in the small intestine and overgrowing, because the MMC, the migrating motor complex, is that sweeping motion, like they call it, crumb cleaning wave. That was a mouthful. And that is very, very important that you understand what it does. So how can you tell if your prokinetic is working? Well, it's that the SIBO doesn't come back. But if you have, it's complicated, I know. If you haven't addressed your underlying cause and you do the prokinetic, your SIBO still might come back. So I have to tell you this story. So in January 15th or 16th, one day is for professionals and one day is for patients. Dr. Allison Seebecker, world-renowned SIBO specialist, friends with Kieran as well. She and I are doing a webinar, one for pros, one for patients, about it's about several things that people aren't getting right about SIBO. And she and I have been working on it for weeks now. We periodically do them when we launch the SIBO Recovery Roadmap course. Whether you want to take the course or not, you should still come. And or you want to take the pro course if you are a professional, you should still come to this webinar. Okay, it's going to be fantastic. So Allison and I were talking, Dr. Seebecker and I were talking, and we're going to tell the story again because it was really profound. We were speaking to another gut health expert, and he said to Dr. Seebecker, it's like you have a chart with everything that works. And, you know, because he was saying that he feels like nobody's really getting SIBO right. And he's like, the way you two are talking is like you have this chart and you have a list of everything that works. And she and I looked at each other and we were like, but we do. It does exist. It absolutely does exist. It is the algorithm that Dr. Mark Pimentel started and that Dr. Steven Sandberg-Lewis and Dr. Allison Seebecker added to. It's on page 110 of my book. It is on SIBO SOS for download. It's the basis of the SIBO Recovery Roadmap course. We're going to go over it on the 15th and 16th. I hope I'm getting those dates right. It's mid-January. Check your emails. But what I love about what Karen was just talking about is the liver, the bile. Why do you think I'm doing a liver gallbladder rescue summit in the spring? It's because of what he was talking about. That is so important. If you don't get that part right, the rest of the treatments might not work. If you get those treatments right and you get your liver gallbladder taken care of with your bile balance and all that, and your stomach acid, You are just setting yourself up for success, is what I have observed as a fellow patient, as someone who is deeply enmeshed in this topic and been in, you know, talking to thousands of people in the Facebook group and hundreds of experts in this. So I was really excited that he talked about that. And know that one of the underlying causes can be food poisoning, from what I just talked about, can also be adhesions, right? So adhesions are internal scars. Well, it's actually a scar that is from a horse kicking you in the belly, or the seatbelt digging in a car accident, or that cesarean section. Collagen forms internal scars to hold you together, which is a miracle, and it makes adhesions, but that can even pull your intestines out of place and impact the migrating motor complex. So it's multifaceted, right? There are resources. There are tons of free things that we have at SIBOSOS and SIBOinfo.com. Hold on. Yes, we are going to send out the recording. I promise. Yeah, we are. The plan is to send out the recording. This is my book, Healing SIBO. It's $20 right now on Amazon. There you go. If you know, there are recipes in there and stuff. It goes over that whole 110. It goes over that whole protocol I was just talking about. And if you can do that in conjunction with what Kieran was talking about, there it is, and get your vagal nerve balanced, you're just continuing to increase your chances of becoming SIBO free, and or at least managing it such a way that it doesn't get worse. Maybe you have an underlying cause that can't be resolved. Doing a pulse of periodic healing along with rebalancing your microbiome is magnificent. Now, I have something else I just quickly want to talk about. I had a sign. I literally have a sign. Hold on. I just reorganized my office. So here it is. Okay. You ready? Breathe. There is something that I have nicknamed SIBO panic. And I want everybody, especially at this time of year, to breathe. There are answers. I swear to you, I promise you, no one has had more SIBO panic than I have. Do you know what it's like to be on national television and have people write you on Facebook? And this is a long time ago before Facebook was so popular. Siobhan, you look glowing. When is the baby due? While you're wearing two pairs of Spanx. I've been so sick that I stuttered because my brain fog was so bad I could not speak. I have been truly terrorized by this. I get it. And I have also come to feel 100% better, 100% better. Remember, for those of you who are like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get well, just keep this in mind, that a managed chronic condition can make you feel 100% better than an unmanaged chronic condition. My company is called Chronic Condition Rescue because when I started this project back in 2016-17, oh my gosh, I had terrible psoriasis. Again, while I'm trying to be a pretty lady on TV, my hair was thinning. I had such bad bloating. I had alopecia, because that's the hair business. I had mold poisoning from being in a building that was moldy for 20 plus years. Oh my gosh. My inflammation in my body, a CRP level, if you're not familiar with that, it's an indicator of inflammation, was as if I had a broken leg. Mm-hmm. So I get it. I really get it. And I promise you there are answers. Wouldn't it be great even if you could feel 20% better? Like, seriously, of course I want you to feel 100% better, but know that there is hope. There are answers. Do not let anyone tell you that this condition is constantly, you know, unresolvable, because that's just not true. If you do your due diligence, you find what's going on with you. And maybe, yeah, you do have an underlying condition like an adhesion that you can't resolve, or a scleroderma, or something horrible like that. God bless. There are still ways to feel better. Okay. So is mold toxicity an underlying cause? So there are people that really feel that it is an underlying cause. There are people who feel like, well, if it's not an underlying cause, it's such an inhibitor to being well, that it's very hard to resolve your condition until you resolve the mold or do it at the same time. there is a phenomenal masterclass we have at SIBO SOS under courses that's $59 well spent by Dr. Ami Kapadia on mold resolution. And she sees a lot of SIBO patients. That is an amazing, amazing class. There's a treasure trove on SIBOSOS.com under courses in the masterclasses that we've done. $59. Get in there and check them out. Ehlers-Danlos, which is the collagen disorder, if you're hypermobility. We have one from Dr. Leonard Weinstock on MCAS and rosacea and restless leg and histamines. We have one on mold. We have a couple on Lyme. Fantastic. We have two on SIFO, small intestine fungal overgrowth. So check it out. Maybe Clarissa, if you could pop in the course. Thank you. She's so good. Thanks, Clarissa. Check out the SIBO SOS Masterclass Vault. Okay. Okay, Holly, take care. Everybody take care. Thank you. I know. David, see, I really appreciate it. I'm so sorry you have trouble walking. Listen, I probably got my first food poisoning at 5. And Dr. C. Becker also had her first experience of SIBO at 5 years old. So I do really appreciate what everybody's going through. Yep. Okay. Any recommendations for liver support? So his MegaGuard, Kieran's MegaGuard is great for that, as are, dandelion. And I'm not a doctor. I'm just giving you the suggestions that I know of. Tudca, T-U-D-C-A. Listen, if you have liver issues, please, thanks, Cindy. Merry Christmas to you too. Please, we will be getting you signed up for the Liver Gallbladder Rescue Summit that comes out in March, starting in January. And when you sign up, you'll get some of the free classes right away. So be sure to sign up for that summit. Okay, I'm gonna wrap up, but I did wanna wish you all the best. Thank you so much for being here. And you're always on my thoughts, and prayers and in my heart and on my mind. And I also just wanna take this opportunity to thank my team who is so devoted to this cause. And just know that 2022 holds a lot of promise. Pray, if you're a prayer warrior like I am, pray for Dr. Pimentel to make the discoveries he needs to make, and for Kieran and his discoveries, and Datis Karazian with the vagal nerve work, and on and on and on. There's one other thing I have to tell you about. When you go to SIBO SOS, and you go to the courses or the vault, let's say you've tried everything. You're like, Siobhan, I've tried it all. I've tried rifaximin, I've tried neomycin, I've tried Prokinetics, I've tried it over and over and over again. I have a great SIBO specialist, like it ain't working, nothing's working. I know what my underlying cause is, it's still not getting better. Remember, it could also be parasites because those symptoms mimic SIBO. It could also be SIFO, small intestine fungal overgrowth. And you've got to watch Dr. Satish Rao's class if you think you have fungal overgrowth. Dr. Ann Hill talks about parasites in a beautiful masterclass. So that's all at SIBO SOS. But we also have another summit, which is called the Next Steps for Treating Tough SIBO. And what that was something that Dr. C. Becker wanted to put together because, well, she is the biggest proponent of the rifaximin, the neomycin, the prokinetic, the formula, because she and Dr. Steven Sandberg Lewis at the SIBO clinic in Portland, doesn't exist the way it did, but they were literally doing SIBO breath tests before, doing treatment and doing after, and they saw what worked. And that's what is so powerful when it comes to that roadmap, because it does work. They have seen it hundreds, thousands of times, but you have to do it in the right order, and you have to perhaps support your bile, perhaps support your stomach acid. So it's complicated. How long did it take for you to get SIBO, right? Did you get it yesterday? No. So it's one of those things where, how long did it take for you to, get in debt? Well, it takes a long time to get out of debt. It's one of those. And I hate to say it because I'd love to say it's so quick and easy. So consider all of that. Hang in there. I hope you have a beautiful holiday season. I know it's already, almost done, but I also wanted to point out that it's a really tough emotional time. There's a lot going on. So give yourself a break. Seriously, breathe. Don't take it too seriously if you can avoid it. I know what it's like to feel terrible. Don't get me wrong. But don't let it rob you of the joy that does exist, that can be harvested, that can be shared. I see it every year now in the Facebook group. There is a 99.9% glorious, but there is a little bit of bitterness that sneaks in during this time. I think it's because we're all reflecting. We don't want to go into another year feeling a certain way. And we, you know, people tend to get very cynical towards the medical community and things like that. And don't let anything get you down. Just don't. I know that sounds easier said than done, but there is so much hope. You just need to breathe step by step, inch by inch, it's a cinch. Okay? I promise. I really do. All right. Happy holidays. Namaste, everyone. Thank you very much. Yes, we will send out the recording. I'm going to get this wrapped up so that I can get the recording off to you. But the more I talk, the less I can do that. So I'm going to say bye. Bye, everybody. Thank you. Here I go. I'm going to hit end. You ready? Okay, bye-bye. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Clarissa.